Welcome. You're living here now?
Yes.
Baruch Hashem. Welcome. Have a klitah tova. Okay. Have a sheet, everyone. Sheet. Okay. Maybe Adir, you'll sit on the end and hand the latecomers, although I'm the latecomer today. I think I need another sheet. Okay. So, yeah. Maybe give the rest to Adir. Josh, give the rest to Adir. Okay, there are the sheets. Okay. Okay, if we don't have enough time tonight, we may have a second part later this week because a lot of the Rebbeim are away, so we'll start tonight because there's certainly one message that I don't want to leave out. Parshas Chukas, you may not have noticed, but 40 years or 38 years have elapsed. Nothing in the Torah says that 38 years have elapsed, but there is a 38-year gap between the end of Parshas Korach and Parshas Chukas. Parshas Korach still occurs within those first 2 years. Okay, if the Meraglim returned around Tisha B'Av, Korach was soon thereafter. It's hard to timestamp Korach, but it's sometime in the summer, late summer, early fall of the second year after Mitzrayim. The decree has already been issued. The people have already been condemned to die. Korach's like the final salvo, the final straw on the camel's back. And then 38 years elapses, and you don't really see it because nothing much happens. The only thing that happens during those 38 years is people die. Every year they crawl into their graves, Tisha B'Av, knowing this year could be their last, and maybe even praying this year should be their last, because what does it mean to live if all you think about is death? And that's why the beginning of Chukas describes the laws of Paraduma, because Paraduma is our response to death, and it's a literary device to remind you that the only thing that occurred during these 38 years were death, the death of a generation, and cleaning the slate for a new generation, new potential, new opportunities. That's very interesting that Rav talked about this. That's why the beginning of Chukas describes the laws of Tumas Nes, because it's a literary device to wink at you. If you were to go to a movie, you'd see the clock turning. How do you describe the passage of time visually or textually? We live time. We know that 12 hours elapses after they've elapsed, but how do you convey that in a narrative, in a movie, in a poem? So one way is to show the clock turning. Another way is to show the calendar leaping through. So this is the Torah's way of more elegantly describing the passage of time and the tragedy that the only thing that happened during these 38 years were years of death and hopelessness and futility. That's why the quintessential chok. This is a chok, zos chukas haTorah. This is a chok, person that dies, and how do you respond to death? Because so much of Judaism is that blend between rational and between that which the human mind can comprehend and understand, and between just accepting HaKadosh Baruch Hu's realities and truths and delivered truths, not necessarily self-mediated truths. If you remember, this is not our first encounter with Paraduma. The first encounter with Paraduma is something I spoke about, although many of the boys here were not in this room. Okay. The first encounter was in Mara. Remember when the Jews were getting prepared for Har Sinai, Hashem gave them some chok u'mishpat v'sham nisa. Hashem gave them some chukim to practice and some mishpatim. But does anyone know some of the mitzvahs Hashem gave them in Mara? Shabbos. Taught them about Shabbos. What else? Dinim. Civil laws, judicial laws, because these are rational. Shabbos makes sense. Every culture needs a day of rest, a day of emotional replenishing. Laws, civility, justice, society, and paraduma. Why of all things, Josh, did HaKadosh Baruch Hu deliver Paraduma in Mara? Sham sam lo choku mishpat v'sham nisau. Because Hashem was orienting towards religion. Religion isn't just about rational, logical, understood parts of Hashem's will, but even those that you just have to accept blindly. Even those that don't make sense to you will never make sense. And in their orientation, in their preparation, in conditioning themselves towards religion in Mara, because that's what it is, it's a few weeks before Hasina, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, they have to learn both parts of religion. The religion is not just the rational, cerebral, cognitive parts, is also the blind faith. And that's why the quintessential chok, the paradigmatic chok of Paraduma, is a response to death, because death is the one part of human life that we just don't have answers for. We don't have the ability to pierce it rationally, to penetrate it. We just don't know what lies on the other side of death, why death occurs, why death is necessary. So Hashem says when it comes to responding to death, an old tumah is contact with death, whether a dead person or the loss of potential, nida, or most of tumah is death, is a dead sheretz. So when it comes to death, we don't really have answers. And this paradigm reminds us that if in death we looked at HaKadosh Baruch Hu to sweep down and to solve death for us with some superimposed system that human mind can't breach, then in other areas as well, things we think we understand, we just don't fully understand. And religion is about that blend. The religion is about belonging and commitment and community and obligation and submission, as well as it is about self-illumination and edification and synchronicity between human mind and Hashem's will. You have to find that balance, and I think in a generation that's finding it harder and harder. They used to speak about Generation X, now it's Generation Y. Harder and harder to fit into institutions and to belong to institutions, to belong to larger organizations and to accept authority. There's an anti-authoritarian perspective in today's Generation Y, because it's much harder to grab it. There's certainly an empowering part to the current generation that, if funneled properly to religion, can empower people to create and to produce in the field of religion. But those parts of religion that call for submission and blind faith and acceptance are much harder today than they once were, because institutions that symbolize acceptance of larger principles are falling apart around us. So that's just the beginning of Parshas Chukas. Everything in Parshas Chukas is really a symbol or a message. Nothing is only purely legal and halachic. So there's a lot to discuss in Parshas Chukas. Just to make sure we don't miss it, let's skip to the end of Chukas, a section that doesn't talk about anything relevant to Paraduma, but it's an extremely, excruciatingly important message about experience, living in a world that so often gets distracted by assumed moral energy or assumed energy that powers our reality, and really you have to locate a deeper energy. Take a look at source number 5. Source number 5 is taken, some psukim, which occur in the end of Sefer, in the end of Parshas Chukas. Does anyone have a Tanakh here? I forgot to bring a Tanakh and to cite these psukim. Anyone have a Tanakh? Okay, I'll just, is that one right back there? Chumash even? Adir? Okay. So, in the end of Parshas Chukas, there's a description about a war which is conducted between Moab and Midian. Now, this war may seem completely, completely trivial, completely irrelevant, because neither of these people are affiliating themselves with the Jewish people. However, there are real stakes. There are real issues at stake here in this war, because the Jewish people were not allowed to attack Moab, because Moab is a descendant of Lot. So if Moab holds these lands, then these lands are off limits to Jews. These lands on the east bank of Israel, the Transjordan area. So if Moab holds these lands, then the Jews will never conquer and will never absorb these lands. But if Midian holds these lands, or Amori, if any of these other nations have these lands, then ultimately the Jewish people can conquer them. So these wars between Moab, and in this case not Midian, but Moab and Amori, are really important wars. So in the end of Parshas Chukas, these wars are described, and the fact that they're described is important, as I mentioned before, but they're described very elaborately, very poetically, very extravagantly. What do we care? It's almost as if Homer enters Parshas Chukas. You read Homer describing these ancient wars of the Greeks, very poetic, very dramatic, very almost epic wars that were meant to be the wars that shaped human history and human civilization. So you pick up in the end of Parshas Chukas, okay, and you can see the Gemara relates to these wars, okay? We read the Gemara in a second. What happened was, okay, that the Jewish people fought with Sihon. This is the introduction. It can be found in Parakhaf Aleph. They fought with Sihon, Melech Amori, and they captured all of his lands, including the lands that Sihon Melech Amori had captured from Moab. So that's the pretext. That's the framework. Jewish people conquer Sihon Melech Amori, this legendary warrior. The Kodesh Baruch Hu intervened. And because Sihon Melech Amori had captured lands from Moab, these lands, which were otherwise unreachable or unattainable for the Jewish people because they were held by Moab, Moab being a descendant of Lot, in this case, the lands were now purified, so to speak, for Jewish absorption, because they were now held by Sihon Melech Amori. So the Torah has to describe how Moab lost the lands to Amori. So listen to these lines. Ki Cheshbon, the metropolis of Cheshbon, this is taken from Chukas, Ir Sihon, was a city of Sihon Melech Amori. This was the capital of Sihon's kingdom, which was then captured by the Jewish people. V'hu nilcham b'melech Moab harishon. Sihon Melech Amori had in turn warred with the first king of Moab, Melech Moab harishon. Vayikach es kol artzo miyado. And Sihon had conquered all of his land, all of Moab's land, on Arnon, until the city of Arnon. Al-Kain, here's where it gets almost satiric. Satiric is a good word. It's almost like a satire, because it's a high language describing nothing of importance. That's real satire. High language. Al-Kain, Yamru HaMoshlim, all the world leaders, announced Yomur HaMoshlim, the Moshels. Bo Cheshbon, let's visit Cheshbon. Let's have a summit in Cheshbon. Tiboneh b'tikonein, Ir Sichon. Let's rebuild the city of Cheshbon. Let's fortify this great metropolis of Cheshbon, of Sichon, metropolis of Cheshbon. Ki esh yatzah mi-Cheshbon, because a fire spread from Cheshbon. L'hava mi-Kiryas Sichon, a flame flickered from the capital of Sichon. Achla ar Moav, and it consumed all the towns of Moav. Ba'lei Bamos Arnon, all the high cliffs of Arnon. Oy lecha Moav, woe is to you Moav. Avadata am Kemosh, you surrendered the people of Kemosh. Nasan banat pleitim, Kemosh has given her sons as refugees. Uvenosav bashvis, and its daughters have been captured. Lemelech Amori Sichon, to the great Sichon, Melech Amori. Vaniram avad cheshbon, and Moav lost cheshbon. Adivon. Who cares? The facts we may need. The Jews have to know that these lands, including Cheshbon, were now held by Sichon and therefore attainable, therefore open for Jewish conquest. Had they been held by Moab, they would be previously unattainable. But why the poetry? Why the lament? Why the cry? Why the woe is to you, Moab, you've lost your lands, your children are refugees? All the leaders are circulating in this newly established metropolis of Cheshbon that had been conquered from Moab and now was becoming the great center of civilization, the cradle of the Middle Eastern Crescent for Melech Amori. Who cares? So Chazal care. And in one of the great turnarounds, Chazal completely redo these psukim. These psukim cannot be referring to ancient wars between Moab and Sichon. The language is too epic. The content is too falsely dramatic. It's too bombastic. The ideas are too pompous for some war who we could care little about, only needing to know the outcome. So now, given that background, let's take a look at the Gemara in Bava Basra Ayin Tes. I'll let you know, this is a Gemara with which the Mesilas Yesharim begins his Sefer. This is the Gemara that the Mesilas Yesharim, Rosh Chaim Litzato, inserts into his Akdama. The Moshlim, the leaders, are not politicians, generals, ambassadors, noblemen, kings, princes, and queens. Al Kain, source number 5, Amr of Shmuel Bar Nachman, Amr of Yochanan, Mai Dechsiv, Al Kain, Yomu HaMoshlim, who are these leaders? Not politicians, not military generals, not celebrities. Elu HaMoshlim B'Yitzram, people who control their Yitzhar. People are fully in control with their will, with their decision-making, with their hormones, with their emotions. People in control. Moshlim b'Yitzram. Bo Cheshbon. They're not visiting a geographical site of Cheshbon. When they say HaMoshlim Bo Cheshbon, the Torah is not referring just to the politicians of 3,000 years ago who congregated and assembled in Cheshbon. The Torah is referring to people who control their Yetzer, who control their decision-making. Every day they say Bo Cheshbon. Source number 5. Bo v'nachashev Cheshbon Shalom. Let's think about what's really important in this world. Hefseid mitzvah k'neged tzchara. The loss that a mitzvah will entail, because every mitzvah is a sacrifice of money, of time, of comfort, of public image, of whatever interests you. But there's a great schar to mitzvah, so obviously the schar outweighs the hefseid. That's the real cheshbon. Schar avera, line 3, negative seida. Every avera has a schar. Physical enjoyment, pleasure, solving a problem easily, lying your way out of a tight situation. Every avera is a schar, but it's tremendous hefseid. Tremendous loss. You're exchanging infinity, eternity for transience. If you follow these leaders, you will build not the city of Cheshbon, but you will be built in this world, the Tikonein Le'olam Haba, and you will be established for eternity. Namely, this section in the end of Chukas is a gloss. It seems to describe politicians and ambassadors and diplomats congregating in the center of the world of Cheshbon and making really important decisions. Bona Cheshbon, Tibonem v'Sikonein, to build Cheshbon or not to build Cheshbon. But what's really happening is the exact opposite. Not the world around us, but the inner world. Not the world of politicians and headlines and wars, but the inner world of morality and values and Torah and Olam Haba. And just when you think that's the real energy that powers the world, the diplomats, the politicians, the Moshlim, the Gemara reminds us, based on these psukim, what really powers history is moral energy, moral decisions, human beings, ideas. It may be quieter, it may be less blatant and glaring. They may grab headlines less. No one's going to say, oh, Josh Kahn made a great decision today about Avodas Hashem and suppressed his Yetzer Hara and served Rabbeinu Shlomo. Shmuel had a great Shmon Esrei today. But those little tiny acts, those moments of decision, multiplied millions of times by people, not just in the ritual field, even people who aren't religious who make brave decisions, even people who aren't Jewish who make brave religious decisions. It's what powers our world. And that's why the satire is so powerful. It's not just a message about the internal world, it's a message of the internal world in place of the external world. Not to get too wrapped up with the world around us, not to ignore it, but not to assume that that's what really shapes history. And that's a problem in this issue. That's a problem for people who aren't tuned out to that world, because we try to tune you to that world. It's important ideologically to serve in the army. It's important to be aware of the world around you. It's important to participate in the world around you, to advance that world. The phrase, the slogan of Tikkun Olam, is one which weighs very heavily on us. But unfortunately, sometimes we let our minds wander, and we let our minds become hypnotized, our imaginations become hypnotized. That's really changing. For me to sit in the base medrash, for me to go have an hour night seder, learn a blat gemara, okay, that's ritual, that's old fogey stuff, that's stuff that... But I'm really making a difference because I'm involved in political action. I'm involved in political influence. I'm involved in leadership. I'm involved in really shaping larger systems and larger people. But you're involved in something more important because more people notice? That's your barometer? The more that people notice something, the more important it is? Well, it's a very poor barometer of importance. Because if noticeability reflects importance and significance and gravitas, well, almost inverse proportion. Most people notice things of trivial value. Most people notice things of empty values. So the challenge is really to be, continue that engagement with the world, but still know that it's a very, very small system. It seems large. It seems to be headline-grabbing. It seems to be powerful. After all, it's weaponry and money and governance, and not to eschew or to avoid that involvement, but certainly, certainly attitudinally, not to get caught into that world where those are the really important things, but the Talmidim sitting in Panavish now in the heat of the summer, turning blot after blot after blot, they're not really changing the world. They're just sitting in some yeshiva off in their own. Or when the boys are in the army in yeshivas, Haratzion, that's when they're really making an impact and a difference. When they're back in yeshiva and they're just learning simple old brachos and bava metziah and davening three times with the minyan, they don't daven in the army. Well, now they're on the sidelines and someone's got to learn. But they have that very, very powerful sense. In the yeshiva world, it's very simple because that empowering sense of Lomdei Torah is taken at the expense of anything else. If you're not learning Torah, you're worthless. The only contribution to our world is the world of Talmud Torah and the world of the base matters. And anything else is either subpar or meaningless. So it's very easy to go, you know, go for broke and to build that sense. In fact, Rav Lichtenstein told us that a lot of this yeshiva attitude was infused in the 20s and 30s, because in the 20s and 30s, the stock of the yeshiva bacher dropped precipitously. World War I brought a lot of poverty. World War I brought a lot of chaos to the yeshiva world. The yeshiva world before World War I was very stable, very gallant, very well-known, very established. World War I, a lot of Jews had to migrate. A lot of Jews were caught behind boundaries which weren't theirs. A lot of Eastern Europeans were caught in Western Europe for a couple of years, and Western Europe was always looked down upon. Oh, those Jews of England and Germany, they don't really have Talmid Chachamim there. The real Talmid Chachamim in Poland and in White Russia. And all of a sudden, Jews were caught there. Poverty was terrible, and of course, the moment that financial difficulty sets in, so the yeshiva bachram are going to be the bigger casualties because they live on the dole, they live on handouts, and no longer were yeshiva bachram able to fetch the highest dowries, you know, by marrying the girls and having their fathers-in-law support them. People who had set up, my great-grandfather was set up, so to speak, to learn his whole life with a really large dowry, and that was going to be his future. He was one of the chosen. And then World War I set in, and his father-in-law went bankrupt. I don't know the details. And then he had to scrape around the rest of his life for a living and always be dependent on others. So the entire stock of the yeshiva bacher dropped. And a lot of people in the Torah world felt the only way we're going to compensate and equalize is by almost inflating the importance of yeshiva bachar, that yeshiva bachar is the only person of importance and nothing else has any value, and only by staying in yeshiva. And certainly the Holocaust lent even greater urgency to that recovery process. So that's not necessarily the attitude we take. We establish or assign value to a range of important occupations, professions, investments, activities, and certainly in Eretz Yisrael, where it has a prophetic and national element, not just in theory, that you're changing the world because you're a doctor healing people, or because you're a policeman who's contributing to public order, but in Eretz Yisrael, where there's a national fabric and a prophetic opportunity and a redemptive evolution, so it has even greater religious significance. But sometimes we devalue Torah, and we see that as quaint and as marginal and as non-impactful or irrelevant to the larger, the real world. How many times do you see people, I'm leaving yeshiva to join? That's a very, very painful word to say. That's a statement should be in no one's tongue ever. This is the real world. There's a many, many real worlds and many real, so this is fake. This is marginal. This is peripheral. And I'm going to join the real world. What type of message are you sending to yourself? Who's really impacting you? You can't kill an idea. The most powerful tank in the world can't trample an idea. Ideas have energy of their own. And as ideas, that's why terrorism is so difficult to uproot, unfortunately, because as much as we don't like to admit it, it's based on ideal. It's based on a dastardly ideal, on an aggressive ideal, on a murderous ideal. It's based on an ideal. And you can't suppress an ideal or an idea. Ideas drive people, families that are hotbeds of ideas, that are incubators of ideas. They drive religious organizations. It's these incubators of idea that really propel human experience. And sometimes we just get lost in our community. As if, you know, my real, how many boys here, after they leave yeshiva 2-3 years, are going to be able to bring the same verve, same excitement to a blot gemara, to a parakin tanaf, to even a ritual moment, to a moment of davening and saying, this is eternal. This will have waves and impacts and ripple effects for millions of years. Politicians come and go. Political parties come and go. You've seen the destabilization of this area, this region. People thought Hosni Mubarak was untoppable, was immovable. Syrian dictatorship was simply too strong to be felt, too strong to be toppled. And all of a sudden you see that whatever conventions, whatever monuments, whatever systems human beings built are more easily torn apart and dismantled than they're built, if anything. When I was your age, we lived under the threat of the Soviet Empire and the Iron Curtain, and this was an impassable, impervious boundary, and no one knew what was happening on the other side. And within weeks, in the early 90s and late 80s, within weeks, it was just walls came tumbling down, and people who had hitherto been feared, these dictators, were just dragged out and summarily shot by execution squads, they and their families. So you don't want to avoid those worlds, you want to participate, and if you feel you can advance them, we don't in any way trivialize them or dismiss them. But there's a very important message to this satire. The real leaders are not necessarily those whose names appear in headlines or in plaques or have all the flashing lights. Real leaders are people who supply moral energy. A lot of people in this building you've met and will meet were real leaders. People won't know their names necessarily beyond these buildings. They won't have more hits on Google than, let's say, famous politicians or generals or celebrities. They won't have Twitter feeds that are as popular. But trust me, the ideas that they deliver to you and the degree to which you absorb those ideals and deliver them with power, with fury, with vision to others, they'll shape thousands and hundreds of thousands of people in enduring fashion. Believe me, I don't know how many hits Rabbi Akiva will get on Google. Rabbi Akiva shaped history, not just Jewish history, but human history, in ways that no one who will outpace him on Google will ever shape. Because whatever impact a celebrity or a politician, these are all ephemeral, they're all transient, they're all passing. Rabbi Akiva's impact on world history, if for nothing else but the fact that he shaped Jewish history, and we are shapers of world history, will endure for eons. And you have that same potential. So I can't tell you where to draw the line, but just be careful that you're drawing the line. And so often, that line is blurred, or if anything, that line is inversed, reversed. So that's why Chazal see this. This is the classic satire. If anyone asks the best satire in the entire Torah, well, one of them may be next week's Parsha, Parsha's Bilam, and we'll talk about that with the donkey. But in many ways, this short little five-pasuk section is just so satiric, as it provides high, epic language about something which, at least to the Jewish readership, would seem insignificant, and then Chazal restore the synchronicity or the compatibility between subject and form by reading different subject into the text. Subject of this text are not those diplomats who assembled in Cheshbon. None of you can name any of them. We don't know where Cheshbon is. We don't know where Arnon is. None of these lands are traceable. None of the details or the program of that seminar or of that summit have any long-lasting input. But what does have long-lasting input is the cheshbon ha-nefesh. And the truth is, I describe this cheshbon ha-nefesh in very, very global terms, but when the Mesil Sisharim quotes this pasuk in his introduction to Mesil Sisharim, he really clocks in as a proponent of a daily cheshbon ha-nefesh. As if every day you should lie down, put your head on the pillow, or before you put your head on the pillow if you're really tired, and think about which mitzvot did you perform that day, which averos, which midos had improper expression, which midos would you like to learn from and improve upon. I remember I had a friend when I was in, grade school. I was very close to him, and unfortunately he died very young. And he told me every night he conducted a cheshbon ha-nefesh, and every night he would sit on his bed and think about what he did right that day, what he did wrong that day, where there's room for improvement. And I started. I remember being so inspired by him that I started to keep a little log. It lasted only a couple of days or weeks. So I'm not sure that we're capable of that same focused, detailed scrutiny, because it can lead to obsessiveness, it can lead to, but from time to time, or even a very coarse, cursory sense of what did I do right today, what did I do wrong today, so that the days don't fold into weeks, and the weeks fold into months, and before you turn around, large swaths of time just pass you without any scrutiny, supervision, inspection. In any good organization, in any well-run company, there are moments of inspection, accountability. Why should the human being be any less? Today we live in the days of large corporations, large organizations that are well-run. Apple's a well-run organization. It's efficient. Part of that efficiency is accountability. It's not just letting people continue in their jobs without inspection, without review, without input, without scrutiny. Why should religion be any less? So many people are accustomed to a cheshbon ha-nefesh once a year. Rosh Hashanah and Kippur, everyone has that sense of bo v'nechashev cheshbon shel olam. What am I doing? But that's where it begins and ends. And even in Rosh Hashanah and Kippur, because it's communal, because it's seasonal, it can become dry, become expected, it become practice. What about the end of every week to look back at the week? What did I succeed in this week? How's my Talmud Torah doing? But every day just to think about one mitzvah you did well that day, one avera, or one deficiency that you weren't so attentive to. Even if it's not a minute by minute, 11 o'clock, I succeeded in this and I failed in this. At 12 o'clock, I seen this and failed in this. Just have a sense of my day is being put to sleep. And what are the areas I can improve upon? Because if not, then it just becomes a rut, becomes a ditch, and a ditch becomes a pit, and a pit becomes an abyss. And then little ruts lead us into these simply unscalable abysses that we just don't have answers for. And so much of life is nipping it in the bud, finding that rut and saying, I'm in a rut right now. My davening needs improvement. My learning needs improvement. My midos need improvement. My avodas Hashem, my Shema Yisrael, whatever it is, and just, okay, tomorrow, next tefillah, we're going to make a change. And the quicker you make that change, the easier it is. Once these things become these long, conditioned human tendencies, almost impossible to break, almost impossible to reshape character. So it is good from time to time, especially when you're in yeshiva and you have that heightened religious awareness, heightened religious consciousness. To say, well, what I do, remember when I came to yeshiva, there were a couple of parts of my personality I wasn't happy with, I wasn't content with, and I took it on myself to make change, and part of the way I made change was thinking about them very consciously at the end of every day. Did I make enough change in this area? Did I make enough change in that area? So there's a global message here, and the global message is super important. Don't be hypnotized by the fancy headlines of people who are applauded or recognized on global level. It's not the recognition that reflects importance. It's a deeper sense of, as I said, moral energy, moral probity, and not just Jewish moral probity. A lot of you will be leaving the yeshiva, and in addition to the role models you take primarily from Jewish and Torah personalities, there will undoubtedly be role models who aren't Torahdik or even aren't Jewish. They can still serve as role models. They live morally upright lifestyles. They live lifestyles of sacrifice and idealism, lifestyles of selflessness, lifestyles of conviction, lifestyles of principle. Those are ideas which are completely congruent with Avodas Hashem. They have to be mapped. They have to be translated. But basically, unfortunately today, you're not always in yeshiva. You're not always in this yeshiva. You're not always in arm's reach of role models who are also religious Torah models. Sometimes you have to mix and match. You have to paste together and say, okay, these are my role models in Torah, but I may not be able to get close enough with them and have enough time with them, but this person really shows me what dignity is, I'm just thinking about some of the people that I met in my life who inspired me on a personal level. Teachers that taught me about organization. People taught me about dignity. People taught me about ideals. because I'm living for values. I'm thinking, each time I say these, I'm thinking of people that aren't even Jewish in many cases, or certainly aren't Rosh Hashiva. I was very fortunate to have Rosh Hashiva, who also are Rabbanim, who also reflected these values to me. But this is not just a message to hold up the Rosh Hashiva as the only person in your mind's eye, but try to differentiate between, try not to get caught in the stampede. There's a cultural stampede. Whoever makes headlines, whoever gets the most hits, whoever gets the most Twitter feeds, these are the people who are obviously important because people are following them. So I hope you have the ability to discern on the extremes people who don't represent anything, empty-headed celebrities, or just get a lot of hits because they act inappropriately or dress inappropriately, or that should be obvious to you, they're not worth your attention. But even people in the middle, the average politician who isn't a scandal-driven celebrity or isn't caught to be a rapist or a murderer or a drug addict or something, okay, they're doing their jobs, they're wonderful people, they should be given our support, but always ask yourself the following question. If your favorite athlete walked in and Rav Lichtenstein walked in to the room together, who would you lunge at first for an autograph or to say hello to? I would hope the answer would be Rav Lichtenstein. If a politician came into the room, okay, now I'm going to try to even the scales a little bit, and your average Rebbe walked into the room, who would you lunge at first to get an autograph for, or not to get an autograph but to speak with? I'd still hope it would be the Rebbe. So now I'm reduced. It's not the Rosh Hashiva, it's not the the meaningless jock or athlete, but so hope you see the people that are delivering moral spirit. Now, it could be politicians that do that as well. Very unlikely. Most politicians aren't delivering moral ideas. Unfortunately, politicians, a lot of drudgery and a lot of day-to-day mechanical work, just making sure that things run. So much of our ideals are besmirched to enter the political arena. And again, I have nothing against politicians, nothing against people that are involved in that world, but it certainly has to be a hierarchy. It certainly has to be in your mind's eye who's contributing to the Cheshbon Olam. So that's really the primary message. I wanted to make sure I didn't miss. Let's take a look. We have 10 minutes. I'll mention one or two other messages. But that's really, that's one of the important ones. A lot of people feel like there's 7 or 8 sichot from this year they want to take with them. When you're stuck and you find yourself in a rut and you feel yourself migrating to the shiny lights and neon signs and the flashy headlines and learning a blot Gemara or reading a parak of Tanakh, which is doing a mitzvah or coming to Minyan during a cold winter day, just doesn't seem to catch you or grab you. So maybe pull out the sicha and listen to it again and read that Gemara and Baba Masra and try to restore the order, the order of significance. Let's take a look at, it's a smaller piece. Let's take a look at source number 3. Again, I think if we have some time this week, maybe I'll schedule a second part to this, just another half an hour or so. But in the middle of the first section, where the Torah is still describing Paraduma and recovery from Paraduma, it's a very interesting pasuk. Zos taras adam ki amus ba'ohel. These are the laws about someone who dies in an ohel. And one of the unique laws of Tumas Meis, most Tuma is conveyed either by physical contact, or in some of the more imaginative cases, not by physical contact, but all sorts of physical, like physics interactions, like pressure, even without contact. So if I push the sheretz, even if I'm not touching it, or the sheretz pushes me, there's pressure, weight bearing, gravity. So I'm carrying certain types of tumah, even if I'm not touching them, or me bearing weight on the item, sitting, riding. So all sorts of physics-based interactions. Tumah, as anyone, I know there's some graduates there. Are you graduates there yet? No. Tumah is very Newtonian, very based on physics. Doesn't just mean demand contact, there are all sorts of different forms of contact. One of them is architectural. So if you find yourself in the same building as a mace, in the same OL, even if there's no physical contact, since you share the same architectural envelope, you're tummy. Tumma transfers to anything in that architectural building, or at least human beings' architecture. So that's the introduction of Zos Taras Adam Ki Yamos Bo'el. If there's a dead body or a piece of a dead body in an OL, Kolosh Bo'el, anything that comes into that oil that's in the oil is tummy. So the Gemara in Brachos for Shlakish feels that this phraseology is just too suspicious. Zos taras hadam ki yamos boha. Look at the juxtaposition between the word tara and the word misa. So what is this juxtaposition meant to evoke? So a very famous statement of Rish Lakish, probably one of the top 10, 15 statements about Talmud Torah. So it's important to learn this, and it's in Brachos, and we're learning Brachos this summer. Amar Reish Lakish, source 3. Brachos, Samach Gimel, I think it's Samach Gimel on the base. Minayin she'ein divrei Torah miskaimin, ela b'mi she'meimis atzmo aleha. In order to be Kone Torah, you have to kill yourself for it. Shenemar, Zos Hatara, Adam Kiyamosba. You want to acquire Tara? Are you prepared to be someone who's Yamosbaha? Now, you could take this statement of Rish Lakish and moderate it a millionfold, and you would still be holding up a challenge that most people today are unwilling to accept. Most people today, they want everything. And everything demands diffusion. Diffusion means you invest a little in this and a little in this, and we're all Renaissance men. Every high school gives us an endless list of options. Teams, debate team, UN team, sports teams, hobbies, cultures, diversions, interests. And the price we pay in general is excellence. Because true excellence is not attained by diffusion, but by concentration. Not by extension or expansion, but by contraction. And until you reach that recognition, not just in religion, but in life, you're always trapped in a cell of mediocrity. You think you're pursuing excellence, but excellence demands shaving. I don't just mean shaving your beard, but shaving options. Disengaging from certain pursuits in order to invest more massively in central, focused pursuits. And certainly where that central focused pursuit is a pursuit of the unreachable will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Torah. Because Torah, by definition, is the most unattainable, unreachable, infinite experience. That's why Gemara is so hard. It's so hard, A, because of your impoverished background in Gemara. But B, even if you knew Gemara well, you're wrestling the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that is always a wrestling match that you will be fated to lose because it's something beyond. Believe me, the more you know in Gemara, the more frustrating Gemara is. The only difference is that frustration becomes ennobling and enjoyable rather than depressing and overwhelming and exasperating. I'm frustrated every sugya I learn. And until I reach that moment of frustration, I don't really taste the true flavor of Torah. When I reach that frustration, I can't go anymore. I can't learn anymore because my mind just is incapable of processing any more of that information, any more of those options, any more of that logic. And then I know I'm looking at Hashem. Then I'm looking at the closest my mind can see at Hashem because I've reached my limits. The more bite-sized, the more organized you turn Torah into, the lower the level, so you alleviate frustration, but you're basically not courting Hashem. You're courting bite-sized, humanized tidbits of Hashem, little like ice cream nuggets that you just put in your mouth, party favors. Just throw down your phone to your mouth. It's not real engaging. Really engaging Torah means you're swimming and drowning in a sea of Torah. So Torah is never meant to be easy. And the greatest Torah scholars sacrifice everything to achieve Torah, not just until they achieve Torah, but once they achieve Torah. Because if anything, the more that they achieve in Torah, the more they realize how relentless and desperate and unconditional the pursuit of Torah has to be. Believe me, Rav Lichtenstein sees the infinity and the eternity, the divinity of Torah more than anyone in this room. And in some ways, he knows how little he knows more than anyone here. Because he's more acutely aware of his limitations in Torah, because the more you know, you can't know it. So even if you're not going to be prepared to kill yourself over Torah, and Chalila v'chas, Yiddishkeit doesn't have a death wish. We don't court death. We don't aspire to death. But are we willing to bring the same magnificent, extraordinary, almost self-annihilating effort to Talmud Torah in order to succeed? Or is Torah something we just punch into our schedule at the best? At the best we punch it into our schedule. At the best. That so much of our labor in yeshiva is to plead with you to at least reach that level. To know that if a day passes, you don't study Torah, there's a glaring hole in your orthodoxy. You can't call yourself an orthodox mill if you don't have Torah study accounted for. It's a mitzvah. I'm not talking about this, the most important mitzvah, the central mitzvah. If you didn't study Torah, now again, there's a day that you're not feeling well and a day that you're preoccupied, obviously, but if it's not routinely scheduled in, then is it like, would you call yourself firm if you don't keep Shabbos or eat Nevela? So at best, we give it its due. At best. That would be my dream. If every single boy would come out of yeshiva and would learn whatever that amount is, X amount of time per day, it would be a totally different world. Totally different world. We're not even there. And then we ratchet that up a bit more and say, well, can I emphasize or can I stress Torah more than other experiences? Can I take every free second and commit it to Talmud Torah? And you're not even close to what Rish Lakish expected of us. You're not even close to the imageries of people sleeping 2 hours a night or 4 hours a night or sitting and learning till the break of Shabbos. Okay, those are stories. Those are legends. Those are things to like dream of. Maybe in yeshiva. Some of you are not yet finished with yeshiva. Have you? I mean, it's so often in yeshiva, a rebbe that I knew, a very provocative rebbe, not in this yeshiva, would always try to provoke the incoming overseas students by saying, "You know, when your year ended," he would say, "the second you got off the plane in Israel," they get all ruffled and agitated. "What do you mean? It's when the year ended? It's when the year began." Say, because that's when you got your handbook and you looked at the schedule. When do I have to be in yeshiva? When do I have to be in Seder? And that effectively is the end of your year. Because if you come to yeshiva to follow the rules, then basically the year ends. Because then you're just following the rules. And what happens when the rules don't support Torah? So you're a rule follower. And you know, the rules are bedrock or baseline. This is the minimum that's expected. Now, how much more can you achieve? So you play with the rules in yeshiva, especially for boys who are continuing in yeshiva. When's the last time you learned during the break? When's the last time you learned Erev Shabbos? When's the last time you learned Matzei Shabbos? At least to taste it, at least to live that legend, right? Some very popular now in America, fantasy camps, where you go and play with the sports legends. You know, you play a few weeks of baseball, a few weeks of football, if you don't know if they have it in South Africa or in England. People pay big money to make believe, to live through spring training or exhibition season, you know, training camp where you train for the sports. To imagine, you know you're never going to be a sports star or an athlete, but at least live the dream, as the billboards say. Live the dream, you know. Go swim with the dolphins, play with the soccer greats, play cricket with... Are you allowing yourself to live the dream in yeshiva? To say, I'm never going to be a B'kivei Eger. I can't sustain the Vilna Gaon's lifestyle my whole life. Impossible. But one day a week, one, you know, slot of my day, I'll imagine, I'm like, no, I'll play with the greats. I'll do the Vilna Gaon thing. 1 week of my life, the last week I'm in yeshiva, if you're leaving yeshiva, that week I'm not going to, or the last month I'm not going to leave, I'm just going to be one track mind, one focus on Talmud Torah. So at least I know that deep down there's a part of me that is able to reach that 14 hours a day for 2 weeks, or for 2 days, or for a week. Sometimes we exonerate ourselves by following the rules, by following what's expected, and sometimes when those expectations are delivered by society that fences us in by capping our ambition rather than stoking it, we just acquit ourselves with a very, very tepid, very, very timid performance in Torah. And every once in a while, you need a Reish Lakish to shake you up, to say, this is not for the cowardly. This is not for the mediocre of heart. This Torah is not. You're never going to really acquire Torah if you give yourself a break or an excuse. Ein ha-Torah niknes. So the next time you feel good about yourself, even you learned your 20 minutes, you pat yourself on the back because everyone around you isn't even doing that much. Say, wait a second, there's the Reish Lakish standard. There's the Vilna Gaon standard. There's the standard, heck, that I saw in yeshiva, that my Rebbe, Rebbe Tarian, some crazy Rebbe who, you know, is screaming at us all the time, that he even dared to pose to us. The guy next to me who's still in yeshiva while I'm in college or army, wherever I am, is still pursuing his 12, 13 hours a night. So I don't know if I can reach it 12, 13 hours a day, but at least, you know, let me push for more than the 20 minutes, or at least if the 20 minutes dissolve and disappear, so make sure that those are retained as like life and death. Life and death. That's what it has to be seen. It's really kihem chayenu ve'arech yameinu. If you sever the cord for Torah, your mom is severing the cord. That's after all this grand facade has elapsed and disappeared, that's all that will be left. None of the celebrities, none of the sports, none of the money, none of the so-called machines. That's all that will be left is kihem chayenu, the only experience in this world that you carry with you the next one is Torah. The only experience. It's the only thing in this world that we'll once again experience in the next world. So everyone has their cheshbonos. We'll make sure that it's part of the cheshba. Okay, we'll stop here. We'll see maybe during the week we'll reconvene for part two. Okay? Sorry about the confusion and the delay. It's all Adir's fault, but...